BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler, and this is the Advertising Trap.
From the New York Times, February 16th, 2012. How companies learn your secrets.
I remember when I read that story and feeling fascinated, but second feeling quite disturbed.
Now, I'd like you to listen to this carefully, if you don't mind, because the tale you're about to hear helps to explain much of what we know or think we know about the modern digital economy. This is the writer and technology researcher Stephanie Hare recalling one newspaper story written about a decade ago.
So the story that was in the New York Times was about the store Target, which is a sort of big American grocery store and so much more. You can get almost anything at Target very affordably. What Target did was it got very big on data analytics and it started profiling its customers based on their purchasing habits. And the story was that they started using their pregnancy prediction score mechanism where they could, based on your purchasing choices, figure out if you were pregnant or if someone in your house was pregnant, possibly before they knew it themselves.
And according to the story, this infuriated one American dad in Minnesota.
"My daughter got this in the mail," the man said. "She's still in high school, and you're sending her coupons for baby clothes and cribs? Are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant?"
But the man's outrage was short-lived. He later checked in with his daughter and discovered more details about what was going on behind his back at home. She was, in fact, pregnant, just as the clever marketing had anticipated.
So I think for some people, it's a fear story. Oh my God, corporations know more about me than I know about myself, and I'm being tracked everywhere. It's the story of, are you paranoid if they're out to get you, to quote Woody Allen. But for other people, I think they heard that story and just went, ka-ching, you know, this is a money gold mine. Are you kidding me? If all of this data is out there and we can be knowing people better than they know themselves and targeting our advertising at them, a beautiful new gold rush awaits us, you know, a data gold rush.
And the story went viral. Interestingly, it was all secondhand. I mean, no one has ever managed to speak to this alleged dad or his daughter from Minnesota.
Yeah, where are they? We need to track them down. And the second point is, like, does it matter if it's true or does it matter if it's possible?
What is possible in this brave new world of big data? Over the next hour, this is the question I'm going to be asking, looking at what could be the power of myth and legend in one particular area of our modern lives, digital advertising. It's an industry worth hundreds of billions of dollars every year. It's one that powers the modern internet as we know it. Firms like Facebook, Google, and others have built their empires on ads, which is why users don't usually pay for their services. But just like the possibly mythical pregnant teen from Minnesota, are we in fact being played by this story of a data-driven ad economy? Are the companies that pay for it being taken for a ride?
Advertisers are basically the ATM of the internet, this entire internet economy. And the entire internet economy is based on advertisers spending more money every year, and most often we are paying for trash.
All of this hyper-targeting, all this AI, all this machine learning, it's total BS, it's total snake oil, and it's actually causing societal harm.
Well, it's a sunny spring day, and I've come now to a place called the Brands Museum in West London. It offers, according to its own marketing, a nostalgic journey through 200 years of consumer culture. And it seems like there's quite a few punters here all too happy to take that trip. Why did you decide to come to this museum?
I'd heard about it from a chap I work with, and I was interested in all the old advertising and how the packaging looked years ago.
Makes me feel old. Yeah, it's nice to see, like you say, all the old sort of stuff. Yeah, we just wanted to do that again, didn't we? You
know. Nostalgic.
Yeah, very.
Can you remember a favourite ad from your youth?
I remember the smash one, what is it, those aliens?
Or MASH get smashed.
That's it, exactly.
What's the other one? Tell them about the honey mummy. The honey monster.
The honey monster, sugar puffs, yeah.
Tell them about the honey mummy.
Cadbury's the gorilla one, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, the gorilla's a great choice, yeah.
I suppose it's nostalgic. You're like, do you remember that back in the day?
Yeah. You have happy memories of all that?
Yeah.
Merriments, too good to hurry mints.
Apparently, even the museum's founder is gripped by the nostalgia. That's Robert Opie. He's a former ad executive himself. He personally collected many of the exhibits on show here, the shiny, often maddening wallpaper that's decorated our broadcast media, our city centres, our lives, all the way back to the 19th century. He showed me round some of those earliest exhibits.
This is the moment when that really started to proliferate with the Industrial Revolution. It was a consumer revolution which really benefited people's lives. Because, of course, what we want constantly is convenience. And that is one of the cornerstones of promoting. It's not only making sure that everybody remembers your brand, but also the benefits that that brand is going to give you.
And you think there's no question that the advertising we're looking at here, the early advertising, did deliver a benefit to ordinary people?
Absolutely, and not only to the everyday middle-class person who can afford these, in many ways, luxuries, but also to the servants who had to clean the homes. But there is a wonderful advertisement. They're called Baldwin's Nervous Pills, and they cure nervousness, quite obviously, irritability of temper, want of strength and energy, fear, dread, neuralgia, hysteria, disturbed sleep, and all nerve pains and diseases, just to make sure it's everything.
All diseases?
Every single thing you can think of.
Do they still sell Baldwin's Nervous Pills? I could use a pack.
Could you? Well, I'm sorry to say that they went out of business many, many years ago.
Maybe their product wasn't quite as good as it promised to be.
Keep that to yourself.
Around this time, there was the famous quote, wasn't there, by John Wanamaker, the American industrialist, one of the great pioneers of American advertising, and he launched department stores out in the States. He said, "I know half of the money I spend on advertising is wasted. I just have no idea which half." How much did advertisers know that their ads were working?
Well, because when they saw the sales figures go skyward, they were reassured. When Smarties, for instance, had a big campaign about how smart Smarties were, the sales were doubling. I mean, it was just astonishing.
So you just saw an instant correlation?
It wouldn't necessarily be instant, but it would be a graph that you could track.
The tracking of ads has never been a precise science, though. It's one thing to correlate a campaign with a surge in sales, but knowing the ad itself has made the difference, well, that's not always the same thing. If the 1960s and 70s were a golden age for broadcast advertising, then the arrival of the internet did deliver a culture shift. For some advertisers, it felt like a fresh start.
Essentially, we liked making funny little films and we hated TV advertising. People were becoming sick of advertising. I think advertising was becoming too pervasive.
This is one of the pioneers of the digital age, Matt Smith, founder of a now defunct London production company called The Viral Factory. His team specialised in creating intriguing video stories meant simply to entertain with little obvious branding. Ads that weren't ads, if you like. And they were often wildly popular.
We thought, you know, we could in a very small way make funny little videos, send them out, and people would email them around. They would go viral. That was a term that had already started thanks to Malcolm Gladwell and his book, The Tipping Point. And millions of people would see them. It would be great and it would be cheap and it would be entertaining.
Describe for me, if you will, one or two of your favourites.
So there's one I really like for a washing machine. The client was Samsung, where a photo shoot is taking place in the snowy wastes of Canada for a washing machine, and a bear appears.
Hey, guys. Guys, we've got company. Let's just move away from Samsung.
It's a bear. It's a bear.
It's fine.
Amazing. And everyone sort of retreats, and you've got a ranger with a rifle saying, don't panic, don't panic.
Let's just give the bear a minute. He's going to move on. Just let the bear be.
And the bear wanders up to the washing machine, sort of sniffs at it, stands up, and then takes its fur off, revealing this sort of teddy bear character in boxer shorts underneath, and sticks it in the washing machine.
Whoa, what?
Thanks to a bit of primitive CGI.
Thanks to an amazing bit of film, you know, Hollywood-level quality CGI, which we paid very little for. It's entertaining, it's funny, but the reason I'm really proud of it is because it was for a washing machine. And I honestly, hand on heart, don't think anyone had ever made an entertaining ad for a washing machine before that time. How many washing machines it sold is a really tricky question. And it's something that used to bother us a lot, which was that we never really knew what kind of impact we were having on the bottom line. But it turns out in advertising agencies that that's quite often the case.
That old problem again. When do ads actually help to sell products? It is a constant theme for us. Sadly for Matt Smith and for his funny little films, going viral wasn't enough. His firm went under. The madmen of the digital age wanted provable profits, and they turned to newfangled data science instead to make it happen. The Danish marketing strategist Anders Hjert recalls how the launch of Google's search engine about 20 years ago provided the first glimpse of what was possible.
This was a revelation. We call it paid search, which is the advertising you see at the top of the results page. It was the first wave of digital advertising that really worked. What this Google paid search does is when a user types a keyword, the ad engine will try to look for an advertiser that matches the same keyword, and then show the ad if that advertiser is bidding higher than other advertisers. So there's an auction model, and all of this happens in real time. So that was the first wave. The second big wave, I kind of count that as when Facebook became really big. It's a very different approach. It's based on characteristics of data that the platform has collected about the user on top of the more sort of general demographic information.
And it's this model that's really taken over in recent years. Digital targeting, or programmatic advertising as it's known. With the likes of Facebook and Google increasingly taking the lead in harvesting data about our habits, tastes, weaknesses, it certainly seems to have changed how we feel about advertising. Compare these students, for instance, to the nostalgic museum goers who we heard from earlier.
I deleted my Instagram just because it was so distracting, the adverts. They seemed like my best friends, that they knew exactly what I wanted when I wanted it. It was so targeted.
The way they collect my personal data and then use it to throw products back out at me, it felt a little bit like an invasive, like, we know something about you.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And they are kind of targeted. You do kind of feel like, definitely like they're watching you.
We live online, so you can't ever get away from it, I don't think.
Well, Facebook and Google alone raked in $300 billion from advertising in just the last year, and most of that is programmatic, reaching us through a magical and totally automated sales process. So how does it work? Well, it is a truly extraordinary process. Sam Tomlinson, head of the marketing and media insight team with the firm PricewaterhouseCoopers, talked me through one example. Imagine a user clicking on a website, for instance, the one for the British newspaper The Guardian. That sets in motion an almost instantaneous chain reaction.
While that web page is loading, based on your previous browsing history, The Guardian will fire off a signal saying, hey, we're about to serve a web page to someone who is probably male, probably affluent, probably based in, let's say, London, probably 18 to 34. That signal would then get sent to a demand-side platform. There will be media agency trading desks bidding based on preset algorithms. Whoever bids the most wins the auction. They then fire a signal to an ad server saying, hey, we've just won the right to serve an ad to someone who's probably male, probably affluent, probably London, probably 1834. What campaigns are we running that fit that criteria? There will be some other decisioning as well. If it's raining outside, let's serve the umbrella ad. The ad creative unit is selected and then served to appear on the web page. And obviously, all of that has to happen in nanoseconds, because that needs to happen as your web page is loading.
So there is an auction for my eyeballs.
There's an auction for your eyeballs. And next time that your web page takes a little longer to load than you would like, it might be because there's all of this happening in the background.
Sounds slick, doesn't it? Millions of ads delivered in fractions of seconds every moment of the day. And the advertisers usually only pay for these when we click on the ad. Brands are forking out some $700 billion a year on digital advertising. And why not, with all this top-level data unpicking our secrets, targeting our very souls? Well, at least, that is the theory.
So my name is Catherine Elizabeth Tucker, and I'm the Professor of Management at MIT Sloan. For the last 10 to 12 years, I have, as an economist, been really trying to investigate what makes advertising work online and what it doesn't. And it turns out that all too often, it's just not working as well as we were led to believe. We recruited a panel of 30,000 people and then saw what happened in terms of what ads they were shown and whether or not it actually matched what we asked for. You know, around 10% people even noticed the ad. So that gives you an idea of the limit of an expectativeness to begin with. But what was really interesting to us is that only about 2% of occasions did you see the ad have any effect on what we're going to call purchase intent. In other words, did it actually affect what people said they might do about the product, let alone actually purchasing it?
So 98% of the time, consumers were basically not even noticing that an ad had been fired at them.
That's basically what we were finding. And that gives you an idea of just how difficult it is to get this online medium to work.
What about the much vaunted targeting that we hear so much about with new advertising, programmatic advertising? Doesn't it help that advertisers can now reach out and to almost touch the people precisely that they wish to reach with their ads?
Well, of course, anything you can do to get your ads in front of more relevant people is going to have a large effect. However, one of the studies I did, we ask advertising networks to show our ads to men. And then we actually measured whether or not it was men who saw them. And we found that actually the ad was being shown to men around half the time, which, if you think about it, is really quite funny.
So, in other words, she's saying, these supposedly laser-targeted ads were actually no better than random at selecting something as simple as someone's gender. It is funny, perhaps, but it's also kind of terrifying if you're an advertiser. We're going to be looking more at the implications of this in the second half of this show. But for now, let's hear about what this apparently lousy targeting feels like for those paying for the ads. Nandini Jammy runs a US watchdog trying to support firms online. But she began her career as a digital marketer for a small British startup, which is when she discovered that the ads were going astray.
I assumed that we would have our ads being placed on CNN or New York Times or NBC News. And instead, what I found was that my ads were appearing on websites I'd never heard of, websites that looked like they had all kinds of weird numbers in them. One website that jumped out at me was a conspiracy theory website. So just not the kind of quality or the kind of websites that my demographic would be engaging with. We did the math later. It was very difficult to sort through and figure out. And I think, and I'm still not sure, we may have gotten two paying customers. We don't even know if they're paying. two customers from this entire campaign. And that means that our campaign cost us £1,500 per customer.
So that's almost $2,000. That sounds like a colossal waste of money.
That's right. And we hooked up our ads to a software that allows us to actually see what users are doing when they log onto our landing page. That is the page you get to when you click on the ad. And we found these arrows like just kind of going dead once the page loaded. And I was like, wow, is my copy that bad? Is this landing page that bad that people just left? And it actually really affected me emotionally. I was like, am I not as good of a copywriter as I thought? And later I realized that it was bots. What was actually happening is a bot was clicking on the ad and then it went dead because the money, you know, the transaction was complete.
So some kind of computerized machine was accessing your ad, clicking on it. For what purpose?
For money. Because advertisers are basically the ATM of the internet. They're the ATM of this entire internet economy. And the entire internet economy is based on advertisers spending a lot of money, more money every year, and not knowing where that money is going.
Nandini Jammy is certainly not the only advertiser experiencing this bot traffic, as it's known. Fake computerized humans, or in some cases real humans, paid for by criminals harvesting money off advertisers. Remember, the deal is the advertiser pays out every time someone clicks on the ad. Here's a similar tale told by a small business owner, Andrew Lissimore, who runs a firm selling high-end headphones out of Vancouver, Canada.
Our ads were showing up in Latin America, and we don't do business there. And we ended up with hundreds of thousands of clicks with no purchases again. We had, 100 first-time visitors from Guatemala, for example, but then 20,000 subsequent clicks. So it meant that there was 100 people basically clicking 2,000 times each, which didn't make any sense. Our site's really great, but no one's coming to our site 2,000 times, especially in a month. So that certainly looked like fraud to me. I don't really know how else to describe it.
Do you feel like the programmatic system of advertising has been good for your customer base?
No, I don't. However, I think that for really small companies, it's really attractive sounding to companies without a ton of resources. We've quadrupled our business since then, and in no small part because we've been able to invest that money elsewhere.
Andrew Lissimore, who's gone back happily, he says, to more conventional methods of promoting his business. So could it really be that this entire system is fundamentally flawed? It's a question we'll be asking over the next half hour. Plus, we'll have a bit of this.
What is a widget? Where would I find hosting configuration? I don't know what I'm doing here. This is a nightmare.
My producer, Johnny, setting up our own low-tech experiment to see how easy it might be for us to extract money from the ad system. Stay with us. BBC World Service, I'm Ed Butler, and welcome back to the second part of The Advertising Trap, the show where we're exploring claims that the digital ad market may be fundamentally flawed.
Hi, my name is Steve Tadelis. In 2012, I was on leave from UC Berkeley working at eBay, where I was tasked to apply economic reasoning to how much was eBay really getting for the dollars they spend on advertising.
Professor Tadelis was about to embark on what you might call a gotcha moment for digital advertising. What he'd noticed was that the people around him at eBay, and lots of other firms too for that matter, were looking simply for crude correlations to prove that their ads were working.
What people do, they just try to see if those people who came and bought from them and they were exposed to ads bought more than people who didn't seem to be exposed to ads. The problem is, if people who are searching for goods get ads and they would go to eBay anyway, then by presenting the ads, eBay is just giving them yet another door to come to the store. So that would be the analogy of digital advertising.
A bit like handing out a pizza flyer to someone who's already come into a pizza restaurant. It's a total waste of time and money. To assess the real effect of eBay's ads, Professor Tadelis decided to adopt a randomized control experiment. He persuaded the company to turn off all its ads in one large region of America to see how that compared with the other areas where the ads were still on display. Surprisingly,
it made no difference at all.
What we found was quite striking. eBay believed that the advertising on paid search, which is one of the channels, was responsible for about 5% of sales. And that was a lot of money. What we showed is that it was an order of magnitude smaller. It was literally about 0.5% of sales. And rather than gaining, eBay was losing many, many millions of dollars a year.
eBay was losing millions of dollars a year. So what did the bosses say when you showed them this research?
Well, they were intrigued, and that, of course, led to a lot of soul searching. Within 24 hours, the president slashed the paid search budget by around $100 million, started doing things differently.
This was back in 2012, and it took a few years, but gradually, other major firms have begun to follow eBay's lead.
We're all wasting way too much time and money on a media supply chain with poor standards adoption, too many players grading their own homework, and too many holes to allow criminals to rip us off.
Saying it like it is to a room full of ad executives, that's Mark Pritchard, chief brand officer at the consumer goods giant Procter & Gamble, very publicly announcing the bold move to withdraw close to $200 million from his firm's digital ad budget. And several other major companies, Airbnb, Chase Manhattan, Uber among them, have also been reining back their ad spend, complaining about losing millions of dollars a year to bots, those software applications widely deployed by fraudsters. By some estimates, bots now deliver 3/4 of all the traffic online.
My name is Mike Jones. I'm a former hacktivist, and I was in pretty deep with anything I could get my hands on as far as technology goes.
Mike knows a lot about bots. Today, he helps to protect agencies and firms from hackers and fraudsters. But back then, he was one of them. Many of his friends, he says, were cashing in on the digital ad market.
I mean, you could build your own website with a random IP address, and next thing you know, you're off to the races, aiming clickbots towards those adverts in order to generate the clicks that you need to roll the money into the door. It's a business. You know, they have call centers built around this. They have a support line you can actually call to get assistance. This is a full-blown industry. It's a money-making industry.
And a shady industry that's believed to be worth at least tens of billions of dollars a year. But even the legitimate ad market seems murky and complex. Remember, a firm creates the ad, often with the help of an ad agency. It's sent off to an array of ad tech firms or exchanges, and then they, plus the likes of Google and Facebook, place the ad on a variety of websites, just as we click on them. Lots of people in that process taking a cut, and lots of opportunity for mis-selling, misdirection, and outright fraud. If ripping it off is as easy as Mike says it is, we wondered, shouldn't we be able to test that?
Okay, so the first thing I need is a website name. What is a widget? Where would I find hosting configuration?
This is Johnny, my producer, and he's not a techie. He really isn't. But today, he's creating a website to see if advertisers can be persuaded to offer us money as well.
So, what we really want to do, Ed, is test this theory that it's fairly simple to set up a website which we can then register with the big ad tech firms who will send a load of adverts our way, who, if we were the bad guys in theory, we could effectively start clicking on ourselves and get paid for.
Right, so we're creating this Scalp News website. Now, it looks, you know, almost good.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can hear the surprise in your voice, Ed, because I most definitely know Mark Zuckerberg. But yeah, you know, because there are so many places online that effectively have all these very, very smart, impressive looking pre-made templates. You just have to kind of put in a few of the basic details and they'll do the rest for you. And the most difficult bit, well, certainly the most time consuming bit, is getting the content. Now, obviously, if I were a bad guy, I could just plagiarize it from everywhere else. We haven't done that. We've taken it from various BBC sites to make it look as legitimate as possible. But it is fairly easy to do this with absolutely no skill or knowledge whatsoever.
Okay, so we've ripped off the BBC. We've stolen their content for the purposes of this exercise. Who are we sending this to? Who decides whether it can attract ads?
So this is where the ad tech firms come in. Effectively, it's all the middlemen who look at our website and say, ah, right, okay, you're a legitimate site. You've got lots of visitors coming each month. You look like the kind of people we want to send adverts to. Obviously, we don't have any of those things. My theory is, though, there will be some firm out there that aren't exactly the most scrupulous, let's say, who will say, yeah, fine, we'll look the other way. You can have some adverts. That's my theory. Whether or not it'll happen, I guess we'll have to see.
Well, we'll return to that. But there is another question here, too. As we surf the web, how many of us are really noticing any of this advertising anyway? Tim Huang is a former Google executive who worked in AI and machine learning. He's now written a book exposing what he calls an attention deficit disorder within programmatic advertising, a kind of shared delusion that big data is brilliantly drilling into our innermost psyches. It really isn't, he says.
You know, when the first banner ads came out in the mid-90s, the click-through rate of those ads was about 50%. That's to say, one in two people, right, that saw the ad, you know, engaged with it. Nowadays, you're very surprised to see click-through rates that are higher than 0.4%, right? We've seen a 100-fold decrease in the effectiveness of these ads in just a few decades, right? It actually turns out that in practice, the system is faulty, full of fraud, and there's actually an even question about whether or not it shapes behavior at all.
These companies, the big companies, the Googles and Facebooks, they definitely say, don't they, that they offer metrics to advertisers, to brands, saying, look, this is who you're reaching. This is how you're reaching them. You think that that data is fundamentally inaccurate?
It seems like a lot of it is accurate, right? But about 28% may be inaccurate. So that means maybe one in four ads being delivered using this data, right, are ending up not where they intended. And I think that you can say, okay, Tim, well, you know, there's a little bit of noise in any data set. Like, what about that other 75%? And that it actually turns out that the algorithms are so good at using this data to figure out who would buy a product that these people actually would have bought the product anyways in the absence of the ad. There's some studies that suggest that actually that accounts for sort of a huge amount of the so-called sort of causal effect that we see on advertising online.
Tim, you used to work in AI and machine learning at Google. How come this system's so rubbish?
Well, I mean, actually, ultimately, machine learning is a kind of a correlation finding machine, right? That's one of the reasons it's so powerful, is there's the promise that it can identify patterns that humans haven't been able to identify before. But one of the interesting things is machine learning has no sense of context. Data predicts who's likely to buy, but they're unable to actually answer the question, is my ad having a causal effect on causing people to buy?
Now, we did ask the big tech firms, both Google and Facebook, to comment on the questions raised in these programs. Neither wanted to give us an interview, but regarding the accuracy of their targeting, Google did give us this comment.
Our advertising business model is designed to show helpful, relevant ads to people. The Media Rating Council certifies that Google's click measurement technology adheres to industry standards for counting clicks and that this technology is accurate. Finally, we have robust advertising policies that protect users, advertisers, and publishers from bad actors to fight against advertising fraud.
We also spoke to representatives of the wider ad industry. Sir Martin Sorrell, for instance, who's one of its biggest names. He founded WPP, the world's largest ad firm, and he's now leading S4 Capital, a new company aimed primarily at programmatic advertising. He says most of the criticisms of the industry are either exaggerated or out of date.
Digital will continue to grow its share of media, like it or not. And consumers do like it at the end of the day. I mean, they wouldn't be responding in the way they are. I mean, our clients are not fools. They track and measure where their advertising spending is gaining the greatest returns. And they can measure it much more easily on digital media than they can do on analog media. There has been waste over the years, and there has been fraud over the years, which people have looked at. But that is now rapidly diminishing. And with technological advances, it really gives you the opportunity to eliminate friction in the system.
You made a claim that fraud is on the decrease in the ad market. I've seen statistics suggesting it's on the increase. It's heading the opposite direction. It might be hundreds of billions of dollars by 2025. You don't see this as...
I don't think it's hundreds of billions of dollars. I think that's an extreme comment. There are still people that exploit the system, as I said to you, but it's being weeded out. And it's in the interests of the big platforms, the three big ones and the others, and Twitter and Snap and Pinterest, to eradicate it slowly over time.
And you have no doubt that they are... Yes, determined absolutely. And serious about doing
absolutely, that. Absolutely, because if what you say is true, it works against them.
Sir Martin Sorrell.
We've got tools to ensure that we provide a fraud-free environment for buyers and publishers. You know, we utilise third-party technology to flag fraudulent inventory, and if it's discovered, we take action against it. And this vigilance has actually resulted in a historically low fraud level across our platform.
The words there of Emma Newman. She represents PubMatic, one of the dozens of usually unseen firms that connect websites with ad exchanges and run those instant auctions for ad space. But despite her assertion that third-party software is weeding out the bots and the fraudsters, ad tech experts we spoke to say it's ineffective. It's still only catching a small fraction of the bad stuff. And in any case, they argue, doesn't all this skirt a bigger question? Whether the targeting actually works in the first place.
We would have to assume that advertisers are naive or stupid, that they would invest in something that just wasn't working or only yielding a very small amount.
This is James Chandler, Chief Marketing Officer at the trade body, the Internet Advertising Bureau in the UK. I put to him one study suggesting that brands were making just a 4% return on their ads. In other words, they were scarcely breaking even.
What the 4% yield doesn't account for is the people that might have seen that ad and taken an action a month on, for example. We don't expect people to watch something on television and then go out the next day and buy a car because they've seen it. That process might take them 3 months, and it's no different for digital advertising.
But there's no way to test that, is there? So the advertisers are just going to have to guess whether their ads are working long term.
No, there's lots of different ways in which you can do it. Of course, you've got all the things like econometrics and market mix modelling, which look at the exposure of different ads and then able to link that with sales data at the other end. So the measurement is very advanced as well.
How come so many large companies we've heard about in the last few years have seemed to have left the market? I mean, Uber alone last year was claiming it had lost $100 million in a year to fraud, and it was pulling out.
Well, I think for every story you get there, you get others. I mean, someone like P&G, probably the biggest advertising spender in the world, have said that their marketing overall is more effective the more money they spend in digital. So when they upped their digital spend, they found that their whole marketing effectiveness overall went up.
Procter & Gamble, you're referring to there, yeah?
Yes.
I mean, they left digital advertising for a while, didn't they? They complained and moved out, but you're saying they've moved back in.
Yeah. It was a great thing because suddenly the whole industry was alive to the fact that the biggest spender in digital is saying, look, we need to clean this thing up. And lots has happened since he made that speech 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, it turns out that he is right. Procter & Gamble are now back into digital advertising, having, we're told, optimised their own algorithms. So perhaps the move to slash their ad budget was just a warning intended to press the ad world to do better. Anyway, today the problems are being addressed, industry people say, and it's the responsibility of advertisers as well as exchanges to check the results. But how easy is it to do that, especially for the smaller firms? I asked the digital marketer Anders Hjert, whose job it is to analyse the returns on ads for companies.
You have very little means of actually measuring the impact. So what you try to measure then is engagement. And actually going back to, and this is what the bigger platforms are doing, you try to go back and do post-campaign surveys.
So you don't know about the engagement, you're guessing, and you do these surveys after the event, which hopefully people respond to. But let's be honest, most of us ignore surveys when they come to us after we've read something. I mean, I'm just wondering how much do we really know about engagement, and how much, as you say, is it just like advertising has always been a bit of a guess?
No, you know a lot of things. I mean, the first solid metrics that we're using is click-through rate. You know, the ones that are showing no clicks or no signs of engagement, you remove them.
But the click-through could be bots.
The click-through could be bots. Yeah, I mean, you can't always know everything. And I think this is one of the reasons why people are so demanding, is that we've built some kind of expectations that you can measure everything. You can't really measure everything, and you can't always know that this wouldn't have happened anyway.
Well, Google and Facebook do say they have made a lot of changes to improve transparency for advertisers. And it's true, they have. In fact, even I can go on to Google now and see precisely what it thinks it knows about me. Some of which, by the way, is weirdly offbeat. I have honestly never liked country music, Google, if you're listening. But anyway, let's get back to that experiment we were running. You remember, the dodgy website.
Ed, it's Johnny. Yes, I have something interesting to tell you about our website. Call me back.
My producer, Johnny, again. So I did.
So you will remember that we were trying to get adverts on our website. And to do that, we had to get in touch with all these ad tech companies. I must have got in touch with more than a dozen. And all of them said, no, I didn't suit the criteria, because we are a website with no traffic. We don't have any of the search engine optimization. Nobody's looking at what we do. I was fast losing hope. I was then on a website forum somewhere in the deepest, darkest parts of the web, where I came across one firm that I hadn't heard of before. And lo and behold, within probably half a day, I started getting adverts on our webpage.
Right. So they are offering us ads, and we're not going to name them. But what are these ads worth? How much would we get for them if we made them active and took payments?
Look, it's not a huge amount. And I'll be honest, the adverts that are appearing are certainly not premium content. However, you can imagine once you start getting a few thousand clicks at just a couple of cents each, it starts to rack up fairly considerably.
So our mini experiment has shown that the big players aren't fooled all that easily, but also that even the most basic attempts at scamming, like ours, can have some success. We did ask the ad exchange in question here to speak to us for this programme. They didn't respond.
It's total BS. It's total snake oil. And I would like the third-party ad tech economy to mostly die and go away and implode.
The veteran ad fraud investigator Augustin Fu is among those hoping for change. He believes the fraud and blatant shortcomings of this industry are finally leading some of his clients, regular advertisers, to review their approach.
Marketers are starting to realize that their spending in digital is not actually producing the results that they thought it was, because they're finally willing to ask. They had been suffering from FOFO before, fear of finding out. They didn't want to find out because it was more convenient to believe that everything worked. But now there's been cracks in this dam, and it's starting to get larger and larger. And that's why I see advertisers actually starting to move away from fraud detection. They're moving more towards audits to say, am I getting what I paid for? And most of them are finding out that they're not.
When you're using apps on your iPhone, you may start to see this. It's the new app tracking transparency.
There is a wider question here, of course. Should these firms even be allowed to track us as they are and trade our private data?
Data like your age, location, health information, spending habits, and your browsing history, to name a few.
An ad from Apple last year promoting software changes meant to limit the spread of so-called third-party cookies or trackers. Google's introducing similar measures next year, although some critics argue the moves are just going to provide big tech firms with an even tighter monopoly on who knows what about us. There's new regulation coming in all the time as well, like the data protection rules being applied by the EU. All of that is good, but it's not enough, according to Carissa Valise. She's an associate professor of philosophy at Oxford Institute for Ethics in AI, and she reckons the entire programmatic ad system should never have been allowed to exist in the first place.
It's risking our democracy, it's eroding equality. Because if you and I are being shown different ads and different opportunities, for instance, because you're a man, you're likely seeing ads for higher paying jobs than I am. And that means we don't have equality of opportunity. It's risking citizens, because all this personal data not only ends up with marketing people, but also gets sold on to data brokers who then sell it on to insurance companies and banks and prospective employers and governments. it's risking national security. It has all these kinds of very negative externalities that are simply not worth it.
There is a deal here, isn't there? Or there has been a bargain, some would say. You give us your data for free, we give you free services like search engines, social media platforms, and so on. If targeted advertising is inefficient, uneconomic, as you're arguing, isn't that going to throw everything in the air? I mean, what are the implications for the way in which the modern digital economy works?
The implications are not as radical as you might expect. Like, we have to remember that 20 years ago, we did just fine without programmatic ads.
But as others, like the ex-Googler Tim Hwang, have to concede, we are talking about the future of a trillion-dollar global industry here.
If this is all a huge bubble, how scared should we be?
I think fairly scared because, you know, this is more than just Mark Zuckerberg having a few less billion dollars in his pocket. There is so much on the internet that relies on this marketplace. So much of the modern sort of media ecosystem actually relies on the continued robustness of programmatic advertising. And we might worry about a world, particularly in questions of sort of equity, a world in which everything is paywalled. Are there other forms of funding the web, right, subscription or otherwise, that can fund the web at the speed and scale that advertising has been able to achieve? When we switch out the kind of core fundamental funding mechanic of the web, things will change. And there may be very hard trade-offs. An internet that largely runs on subscription looks very different from an internet that runs on advertising.
Okay, but perhaps we're getting ahead of ourselves here. The ad industry is still booming after all. And despite some rocky recent results for Facebook, it continues to grow at breakneck speed. James Chandler of the Internet Advertising Bureau says it's delivering all kinds of economic benefits to us all as well. And the reports of its demise, well, they're greatly exaggerated.
I remember lots of conversations about ad blockers years ago when ad blockers were effectively going to kill this digital advertising model. They've actually gone down since everyone got very excited by them. Just the pace of change. Television is becoming programmatic. Out-of-home ads are being bought in an automated way. Radio, things like Spotify, Acast are all being bought programmatically. So the term digital is going to become quite redundant because that's the way and the means by which all advertising is going to be bought. And we're there already.
I have to level with you. I have no idea whether the digital advertising economy is at risk. It may have problems, of course, but then that could just be the usual bleeding edge of a new technological frontier, a market that's coming to understand its limitations. Professor Catherine Tucker may have helped to expose many of those flaws, but even she thinks this new data-driven technology is here to stay.
Advertising has always been unsatisfactory. Think about newspaper advertising. It's always been the case that people may not see the ad, they may throw it away, they may not look at it, they may spill coffee over it. We've just never been able to measure that before. Now we can actually measure this, and we're seeing these huge, surprising, what I would call oh moments, in terms of how off we are from our expectations. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about digital media. We can at least start to measure where we're going wrong. That's a wonderful outcome and something we've never been able to do before. So the more advertisers can move to actually measuring how well their ads are performing rather than something else, we're going to be able to do a lot better.
I began these programs with the story of how an advertiser knew a teenager was pregnant before she did. Was it true? Maybe. It's probably the case that targeted digital ads do hit their target more often than all those billboards or TV commercials did back in the day. But that's still a pretty low bar, isn't it? And it doesn't necessarily mean that they match up to the bold claims, the idea of all-knowing, all-seeing firms tracking every detail of our daily lives. Of course, for some of us, that will be a good thing. But the growth of this murky, seemingly unregulated corporate world has also accelerated a deeper kind of unease, a mistrust, uncertainty. What exactly is it that we've all signed up for? This has been The Advertising Trap, with production from Johnny Iansen. It was edited by Hugh Levinson, and the studio production was by Neil Churchill. It was produced and presented by me, I'm Ed Butler.